Okay, I'm ready. I am ready now.
I am
So,
ready as well.
oh, that's a fascinating accent you just did. Welcome, everyone, to episode 22 of Debating Doctor Who. I'm Alistair Wilkins.
And I'm Caroline Seda.
And we got a lot to talk about today. We're going to be talking about Mummy on the Orient Express, the latest Series 8 episode. And we're going to be talking about a pair of episodes that are kind of similar to Mummy on the Orient Express in that they're kind of weird space romps that take dark turns. We're going to be looking at the Christmas special from the 10th Doctor era, Voyage of the Damned. And we're going to be looking at Dinosaurs on a Spaceship from the first half of Series 7 with the 11th Doctor and a whole menagerie of companions in that one, actually. So we'll get to that later. But first, Caroline, I believe...
Oh, I beat you to it this time.
You
That's
did.
How excited I am.
That was a celebration ambush, and I like it.
Well, I'm particularly excited because we had a lot of people get in touch with us this week, and that always makes me very happy. We actually heard from Danielle herself of the Danielle Fan Email Award, who tweeted at us, at DebatingDW, to tell us that she started watching Grace Point, thanks to hearing us mention it on the podcast. So, Danielle, I hope you like that. But this week's Danielle Fan Email of the Week Award actually goes to Brian from LA. He is a new listener. And Alistair, he wrote just this morning to compliment your AV Club reviews of Doctor Who, and he had this to say. It's particularly rare these days to find any sort of TV criticism that's more essay than capsule review or Wikipedia summary, and in the case of Who, it's even rarer to find someone willing to throw in more than just the odd token reference to the original series. It's particularly refreshing to read something wherein the writer justifies his stance in glorious detail. I know I'm not the only reader able to recall many of the fleeting emotions and forgotten questions formed during the viewing of those episodes, and I hope I'm not the only one to happily reevaluate what it is I've just seen. So Alistair, you have a big fan in LA in Brian, and Brian, I totally agree with you on all of this. I thought this was a great summary of kind of my experience I have when reading well-written reviews of shows, including Alistair's of Doctor Who.
Well, I'm blushing. I don't really have a comment beyond that. Thank you, Caroline, and thank you, Brian. That's a lovely email, and it's very much appreciated. As particularly as I've said a few times, I didn't think my 7B reviews were quite what I wanted them to be. It's a hard show to review. It's kind of tricky to find the right perspective, and I think 7B was just a weird time for the franchise and for, like, you know, kind of discussion of the franchise. You know what I mean, Caroline?
Mm-hmm,
just a very weird, divisive time, and, you know, not unjustified. But so Series 8, I think, has been a lot kinder to everyone involved, and I'm glad that people are digging what I'm doing with the reviews, because they take a little time to write. But I think so far they've been worth it. So I'm glad people are appreciating it.
Well, another thing to make your morning, Alistair, we got a tweet from Lindsay. As per your request to send fun hypothetical questions for us to answer on the show, and she wants to know, in a hypothetical meeting of Ian at Coal Hill School this season, a meeting of Ian and the 12th Doctor at Coal Hill School this season, what do you think would happen? So, Alistair, this is, of course, referring to one of the first Doctor's companions, Ian, is that correct?
Yes, Ian Chesterton,
Great.
One of the teachers
and
at Coal Hill
so
School.
So you're going to be the better one to answer this question mm-hmm. than I am. So I'm sure there are many things that would happen, but you want to give us, like, your number one thing that you think would happen between them?
I think that there would be some lovely callbacks to the First Doctor era. I believe it was Ian who said something along the lines of, you know, this all started out as just a strange incident in a junkyard, but now it's become a great spirit of adventure. And I'd love to have some sort of callback to a line like that or something to that effect. But I think the thing about Ian is that the way that the show was originally structured was he was really the leading man of the show. William Russell, a very traditional leading man type and a very good actor, and he's still doing Doctor Who now, pushing 90, which is awesome. He's also the father of, I believe his name's Russell Enoch, who plays Dean Thomas in the Harry Potter movies. So,
oh.
just a little trivia there. But I would love for them to kind of reaffirm what Ian meant to the first Doctor, which was he was the guy who really helped show the Doctor that there was a more moral way to interact with the universe. The first Doctor started out as a very amoral creature, not necessarily in touch with the more heroic side that later Doctors would find. And I think with the 12th Doctor, we're sort of seeing a return to that to some degree, a less self-consciously heroic approach. So if there were a way, even just to reaffirm with just a sort of a twinkle in William Russell's eyes, that's something that the Doctor cares about and has learned from humans, I think that that's sort of the number one thing I'd like to see, just a little aside of a scene that kind of reaffirms that aspect of the Doctor Who experience and why those original companions, Ian and Barbara, were so important to the first Doctor's development.
Well, Lindsay, I hope that answers your question. Thank you so much for sending it in.
Thanks, Lindsay. You're the best.
Yeah, you really are.
You're all the best, just for the record. But Lindsay was the best this week because she tweeted back at us, which is cool.
If you have a fun hypothetical question for us, please send it our way at DebatingDW on Twitter, or we are DebatingDoctorWho@gmail.com. We got one final email this week from our most common emailer, Barb, who writes us a lot with wonderful thoughts each week.
I think most frequent is the frequent. Is more complimentary.
That's
way
a word that,
that
I forgot existed in the English language. Barb wrote us to kind of just give our thoughts on last week's episode, and she made some interesting points that I think kind of encapsulates how a lot of people are
and
feeling.
Just to clarify, last week means kill the moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just because I think by the time this comes out, it'll be like 2 weeks ago.
So in relation to Kill the Moon,
yes.
Barb, I think, struggled a little bit with the Clara-Doctor confrontation scene at the end of the episode. She said that she, unlike us, where we were kind of on Clara's side, she struggled to kind of feel sympathy for Clara in that scene. But she also pointed out that in a very similar scene in The Girl Who Waited, where Rory kind of takes down the Doctor, she was on Rory's side. And she pointed out that that was a little bit hypocritical of her. And almost immediately after reading Barb's email, I stumbled across this really fascinating New York Times article that was actually talking about business reviews at companies. And I thought this was kind of relevant to Barb's point. So in this article, it pointed out that over 248 reviews from 28 companies, both male and female managers, gave female employees more negative feedback than they gave male employees, and that 76% of the negative feedback given to women included some kind of personality criticism, such as comments that the women were abrasive, judgmental, or strident, and only 2% of men's critical reviews included negative personality comments. And I think this is just a really good reminder, really for everyone, myself included, that it is so easy to judge women in general, but female characters in particular, in a way that is much harsher than we judge male characters. And I was so excited to see Barb kind of identify this in herself and sort of, you know, start to think about it. I think that that's a thing I do often when I have a really strong reaction to a female character is think, well, you know, why am I reacting this way? Is this sort of something judgmental that has been socialized in me? So I just thought it was cool that those two things came across my path in the same time frame, and I'm excited to see Barb and myself kind of try to push past this kind of judgmental thing that we kind of do to female characters.
Well, it's a very profound point, and I mean, I'll just sort of co-sign on that. I think that you've said it very very well, Caroline. I think is that the end of our mailbag for this week?
That is.
Then the only other bit of business that we have to get in before we get to the shows is a little belated, but happy birthday, Caroline.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you did it for me in the second episode, so
yeah,
I got to repay the favor. So,
I forgot about that.
Do you have a nice time?
I did have a nice time. I am still younger than the Doctor, but I think officially older than a majority of the companions now. So that's me on my life path as related to Doctor Who.
Excellent. Well, let's get into the episode now without any further ado. Let's talk about this latest episode, Mummy on the Orient Express. And as always, our constant caveat, we will be discussing everything. Everything's on the table. So if you're looking to avoid any spoilers, then, you know, you won't want to listen to this next bit. Just go watch the episode, then come back and listen. It'll be fun. And also, we do encourage you to read my review on the AV Club first, just to go through particularly my thinking so that we can now hear what Caroline has to say about the episode. So take us away.
So like Brian, I thought that your review was very well structured, very well argued. You were a big fan of this episode, and I thought you made really fantastic points in terms of why you were a big fan.
Oh, there's a butt coming.
But this episode did not work for me at all, I have to say. I think I've had a stronger negative reaction to this than most people. I was not really a fan of Mummy on the Orient Express. And there's a couple reasons for that. Sort of the more minor reasons is that I wasn't thrilled with the world building, and I thought the characters were fairly thinly drawn. I think an example of this is that once we get this twist that this is actually Gus the computer who set up this lab for all of these experts to study and figure out what this, you know, creepy mummy that kills people is, essentially that whole part of the episode could just be cut and the episode would be the same. Like, that was actually inessential. This could have just been the doctor on a train, you know, with the help of some random passengers. You know, none of those scientist people ended up being important. In fact, it was the engineer who was already on the train that was important. I also wasn't thrilled with the way Clara was kind of trapped in a room for most of the episode. I think that that was mostly a logistical thing because they probably needed Jenna Coleman to film more, because I know next week is very Clara heavy. But I thought that was really awkwardly handled and it could have been a little bit more eloquent. But all of that pales in comparison to my biggest concern with this episode, which is the 12th Doctor. I feel like every week I go back and forth on whether I like this darker 12th Doctor or whether I don't like it. I think it's a very hard balance to find to make your protagonist so kind of cruel at times or dark, but still likable. And sometimes they find that balance really well. This week, I didn't think they did at all. I thought that the Doctor's like total lack of empathy for the situation, for the people that were dying, and is kind of almost like glee at getting to solve this problem scientifically just felt so off for the character. And I think the only way I can summarize it or explain how I feel is I feel like the 10th Doctor in New Earth, when Rose's body gets taken over and he's like, what happened to Rose? This isn't her. Rose would care. And I was thinking that this whole episode, except I was saying, you know, what happened to the Doctor? The Doctor would care.
Well, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I'm disappointed. No, I don't know. I totally, I mean, you know, I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think that it's one of those things where it kind of comes down to what you're looking for in the character to some degree. And I think that to me, it's one of those things where what I think Mummy on the Orient Express is trying to do. And again, you know, I'll just say it right now. I think it absolutely succeeds in doing this, but let's leave aside the question of what it succeeds or whether it succeeds or not. Let's just see if we can drill down on what it's attempting to do. I think what it's attempting to do is to show, okay, the Doctor, he does care, but it's an alien kind of caring. It's not a human kind of caring. It's a very big picture utilitarian kind of thing. And, you know, when Perkins the engineer is standing over the body of, I think it's Captain Quell, and is saying, can't we take a moment to grieve? And the Doctor says, no, people with guns to their heads don't have time to grieve. And essentially what I think the episode is trying to do, and this is the point I made in my review, is it's attempting to kind of contrive this scenario in which the Doctor really doesn't have the luxury of any kind. He just does not have any kind of time for any sort of false sentiment, and is trying to show, okay, you know, how does the Doctor go about interacting in this situation where, as I say, there just is no time for that sort of thing. And it's not saying that this is an incarnation who's naturally interested in that. And, you know, it's definitely coming down on a darker interpretation of certainly this Doctor, and whether you think it's generalizable to the Doctor as a whole is up for debate. But, you know, again, I thought it worked because I thought that it made its argument persuasively. If you don't like the argument that it's making, then, you know, that kind of comes down to a personal preference kind of thing.
I mean, I think you're right that that is what the episode is trying to do, is show his, like, extreme practicality in these situations. And I don't necessarily want that to change, but I think there's a way to do that without going to the extreme that this episode went to. You know, this, I understand the 12th Doctor's different. He doesn't need to do that constant, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry that I know a lot of people got sick of the 10th Doctor doing. But it felt cruel beyond, it felt cruel in a way that hindered his attempts to manage the situation, not in a way that helped it. Because I think part of what I like about the Doctor is that he is able to sort of celebrate the individual achievements of various people. He's able to take a very kind of diverse group, bring them together, highlight their strengths, and use that group mentality to help save the day. Like, he's very good at rallying the troops. And this felt like an episode in which he was not doing that. He was not rallying the troops. He was not inspiring people to help him. He was kind of becoming a dictator, and he was saying, my way is the only right way. No one is allowed to have emotion. Like, in this situation, in fact, a tiny bit of empathy could have inspired all of those scientist people to help. Like, I don't think this was the best way to go about trying to get everybody in the room to be on the same page. And it just felt cruelly cavalier to, in someone's last 60 seconds of life, be yelling at them. And again, I understand the practicality of that. There's an interesting idea of, you know, we can't really be emotional because we have to get as much done in your last 60 seconds. But I don't know, it felt like they stepped a little bit too far over the line. And if they had just reeled it back a little, they could have kept this same sort of harshness, but not go too far with it. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. I mean, I just disagree that was something that was a problem with the episode. But I mean, I understand if that's something you want to see from the Doctor, then, you know, it's hard to argue that point. I mean, I definitely fall in the camp where, to me, the sort of I'm so sorry thing, it became shtick. It became a catchphrase for me. And it felt like there's a point in it's Journey's End where Jackie is saying it to someone who's about to be incinerated by the Daleks. And it's just like, this has lost all meaning, because it's just a way for it just felt like a way for the show to sort of, you know, hand wave the fact that it was privileging the existence of certain characters over others, that they just have to be sorry about it and it's okay for them to survive where others will die in really horrible ways. And so, again, it's this thing where, you know, to me, with the 10th and the 11th Doctors, it was this feeling of, well, you know, they do make a big show of caring, but again, if they never actually change the way that they operate, is that, how much does that matter at a certain point? With this Doctor, it feels more honest. I guess the other thing that I would just say is, to me, I think Mummy on the Orient Express, its success really comes down to that. It's not the final scene, but it's the penultimate scene. Much like with Kill the Moon, really depends on that scene with Clara telling the Doctor off, where the Doctor is on the beach, and he's being very honest about, you know, well, you know, if you want to believe certain things about me, that's okay. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm just trying to win. And, you know, I'm there to make the impossible decisions that no one else wants to make. And so, you know, it's one of those things where there's a lot to unpack in that scene. And I can't go through all of it right now. But it felt like a very powerful scene, certainly for me, both in terms of the writing and also in terms of Capaldi's acting and how it seemed to be a culmination of a lot of the things that the show had been saying about the 12th Doctor over the course of the season. Like, a lot of the things that they were saying in a very sketchy, preliminary way and into the Dalek felt like it was paying off here in a big way. So it felt like a very good continuation of the season-long arc. But, you know, like, again, if you don't like the arc, it's kind of, you know, I don't know. I don't think there's a way to argue one out of that dislike of it.
Yeah, it's tricky right now because I do think we're being set up for a situation in which, by the season finale, the Doctor is going to realize some of his flaws. I think the season is very intentionally pushing him too far. Certainly, you know, with his hatred of Danny, that sort of stuff. Like, we're kind of, I think he's going to get his comeuppance. So it's almost a little bit hard to judge his arc, I guess, when we're in the middle of it. It's very possible that whatever happens in the season finale will kind of change my mind looking back on this episode. But I think something that did work that you just mentioned is I actually did like Clara and the Doctor's relationship in this episode. It was a little frustrating that we pick up kind of with them back together and we, the audience, didn't get to see whatever reconciliation scene happened between, you know, Clara storming off at the end of Kill the Moon and then agreeing to come back for one last trip. But that aside, I actually thought this kind of, you know, one last hurrah was played really bittersweet, really lovely. That idea of, you know, Clara having this sad smile and kind of being torn between wanting this to be one last lovely but boring adventure or one, you know, kind of exciting, dangerous adventure, and that push-pull. And I do think it's interesting to have this kind of addiction metaphor, this idea that Clara, you know, just can't leave him behind. And I think that we're in a situation where they're both sort of not at their best, I guess. And like I said, I really do think we're heading to some sort of big fallout at the end of this season that will kind of deal with both of those sides of their personality.
Yeah, the sense of foreboding at the end of the episode where, you know, they're sort of triumphantly, giddily going off into space, and you know they're doomed at that point. It's the storm is a brewing, and there's that point for, I think, some of the previous well, it's like the end of Power of Three or the end of Fear Her for the second or the tenth Doctor and Rose. Like, you just know, okay, there's just no way this can end well at this point. This is a point of no return. And I thought that was cool. And you know, I agree with you. It was one of those things where I think the BBC definitely, and they tweaked the synopsis of the episode to remove Clara's name from it to, I think, make a lot of people think, oh, the Doctor will be off on his own. And they left Clara out of the trailer for this at the end of Kill the Moon. And so there was an initial disappointment to actually see Clara. And I was like, oh, that feels like this could have been interesting. But I thought that the subsequent scene where the Doctor is just sort of bantering and refusing to engage with, you know, the emotions that she's bringing up, I think kind of underlined the point that, you know, the reconciliation is Clara said, okay, I'm willing to go back off with you, and the 12th Doctor said, good. And like that was probably the extent of it. And I think that, you know, again, it's that thing where you don't need to see that because there's nothing worth seeing. You are skipping ahead to the next part of the story that is worth seeing where, you know, I think it is – I agree with you that keeping Clara in the room is – it is not as it's definitely clumsier than, say, keeping the 11th Doctor in the TARDIS for all of Girl Who Waited isn't quite as good a sleight of hand from a production standpoint. You know, I did like the fact that, you know, Clara is, you know, asked to lie for the Doctor one more time and how upset she is. And then, you know, there is that twist where it does turn out, you know, the Doctor has this secret plan to save Maisie. You know, there's definitely some, he's not all the way cruel in this episode. And, you know, but again, it's that thing where he is cruel enough, and it's that thing where I think it's the old Vonnegut line, you are what you pretend to be, and even if he's pretending to be cruel in this episode, there's very little functional difference between pretending to be cruel and actually being cruel.
Yeah, exactly, and I think that the kindness and the celebration of humanity is so much about what I like about this show, and I guess, you know, you're right, it's a personal thing, but it was a little disappointing to lose that. Other things that I did think work, though, because I think on the whole, this wasn't even an episode that there were a lot of things I dislike about it. I wouldn't even say it was an episode that I actively hate the way there are some episodes of Doctor Who I just can't stand. As much as the world building I thought was a little shallow, the look of the episode was really fun. I really liked the costuming. I actually thought the mummy was one of the best effects that they've had on the show in a long time. It was genuinely creepy. It looked very realistic. I think it was smart that they kind of used an actor mostly in like a costume and makeup and then kind of added some CGI effects after the fact. But I actually thought that thing was like super creepy in a way. I don't really think of mummies as being scary. I think of them as being silly, but this guy was actually really freaky.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely got across the sort of withered, desiccated aspect of the mummy and were able to pull that off to a great extent. So it is quite a disquieting, disturbing design, and I think you're right that it's a well executed monster.
And then I guess the other things in this episode that they kind of were billing ahead of the fact, the Queen cover by British singer Foxes, I love. Don't Stop Me Now is one of my all-time favorite songs, so that was a fun little jazzy cover of it. And then Frank Skinner as the engineer Perkins, who I don't know if this is weird, but I had literally never heard of Frank Skinner before this
episode. I think he's a very good example of someone who's super famous and a household name in the UK and has just zero US exposure whatsoever, because he doesn't do TV particularly. Yeah. It's like, unless you're watching panel shows, basically, that's really the one place you'd see him, or on like chat shows, which are the ones that they're the things that travel across the pond the least. Mm-hmm. So it's in no way surprising to me that you don't know who Frank Skinner is.
Yeah, it was funny because I think watching this episode, to me, he was sort of the equal to all of the other, you know, guest actors like Maisie or the captain. It wasn't like he particularly stood out. But then it's funny to go back and watch some of the behind the scenes or the promotional things. And he's so, you know, heavily promoted because he is this figure. I mean, I thought he was fine. I can't say I felt fully one way or the other about Perkins, although my favorite line of the episode might have been when he hands the Doctor all of the plans and the Doctor looks at him very suspiciously and he says, well, of course, it's because I'm the mummy. or because I was already researching this before. That one was a laugh out loud line for me.
Yeah, I thought that I kind of liked Perkins as the sort of de facto companion while Clara is off in her mm-hmm. room. I thought that he was well used in that regard. And I did like the final little scene that he has in the TARDIS with the Doctor, and the Doctor's basically offering him a spot, you know, on the ship. And Perkins turns it down on the grounds that he's afraid of what it would change him into. I thought it was a nice way to sort of buttress the metaphor they were about to go, the addiction metaphor they were mm-hmm. about to go into, because Clara definitely has been changed by the experience and can't walk away from it. So I thought it was a nice little dramatic scene played between Capaldi and Skinner. And I thought, you know, again, I don't think it's revelatory or anything, but, you know, I generally enjoyed his presence in the episode. I think, you know, I thought across the board the guest cast was pretty good here, although I think you do make a good point that the sort of scientific experiment thing is a clever conceit, but I will admit they don't actually do all that much with it because they are basically extras, the scientists. And I sort of noticed it as I was watching, but I was, to be honest, just sort of bewitched by Peter Capaldi's performance to the extent that I didn't really care about it very much, because this felt like the Capaldiest episode we've had so far, to coin a term.
A Capaldiest. I think that's fair. You know, Doctor Who, it's easy to kind of, if there's a lot of stuff to like, I think it's really easy to kind of not be so bothered by the weak parts. And it's like me right now, when you kind of have a central issue with the episode, it's a lot easier to kind of pick apart other things. But do you have any last thoughts here or last defenses of the 12th Doctor? Because I know you were a much bigger fan of this episode than I was. And again, I thought your review argued that very eloquently.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't think it's so much a defense. It's sort of this thing of, I do think that the Doctor can be a darker character, that, you know, I do understand that when 10 is such a formative character for you, and I mean, I know that, you know, the 9th Doctor was your first mm-hmm. and was a darker-edged character, but still, you know, he was sort of he could be sort of a jerk and could be kind of, you know, prickly, but at mm-hmm. the same time, it was very clear he felt emotions very deeply in a way that the 12th Doctor doesn't. Like, I think that it's a mistake to say 9 and 12 are, they have some similarities, but are also extremely different characters in other ways. So I do understand that there's not a ton of precedent in the new series for what they're doing with the 12th Doctor. I do think that, again, I think it's well executed is the thing that I would mm-hmm. argue the most strongly. And then it just is a question of how broad do you think Doctor Who can go? How wide a canvas can it operate in terms of its characterization? And, you know, it is this thing where if they had not had the sort of switches at the end where the Doctor does take on Maisie's trauma so that the mummy can see mm-hmm. him. And I mean, that's the other thing is, and I brought this on the review, and I will admit, I think the episode could have punched this point a little harder, but it wasn't hard for me to bring it out just because I was generally liking the episode. But I thought part of it is the idea that the Doctor rallies the troops when he can put himself between the troops and the monster. And he can't do that in this episode. It's one where the monster literally walks right through him at one point, and he is quite impotent in terms of his ability to deal with the monster, and part of the reason why he has to get as much information as he can out of the people as they die. So, you know, I think there's a lot of really interesting ideas here, and again, I was completely on board with them. But, you know, again, Doctor Who, there's like a million different ways to watch it, and they're all valid. So it's one of those things where I can't in good conscience say, no, you're wrong for not liking this episode very much. It's probably, you know, it's probably akin to how I feel about something like, I don't want to say Tooth and Claw, because I think Tooth and Claw has deeper issues than Mummy, although perhaps, again, it is that thing where I dislike the central relationship so much that all the other stuff that I might be willing to excuse just annoy me. And, you know, I don't think there's anything as in Mummy and the Air Express that's as dumb as the Kung Fu Monks.
I would agree with that.
I think that's a fair statement. But yeah, this is probably a Tooth and Claw kind of scenario where you can kind of see it has the veneer of quality, and you can understand why a lot of people really love it. But at the same time, if it sort of just turns you off, if it's not something you like watching, it's real hard to get on board with that. And so I think that everyone is going to have that one episode that just doesn't work for them.
And overall, I think that the critical and fan consensus has been much more on your side than on my side. So I acknowledge I'm a bit of a lone voice, a lone wolf in this situation.
You've been there many a time. It has to be said.
I'm used to this.
You are the minority report.
My final thought is that I thought I knew what a jelly baby was, and I learned that I did not. I thought they were jelly beans.
Yeah, they're babies.
I see that now.
Yeah, the name is not just the British being obtuse for a reason. For no reason. There is like an actual theory behind them. Yeah, that was apparently, according to Jamie Matheson's AMA on Reddit, that was Peter Capaldi's idea to put them in the cigarette case, which is that's some strong fanboying right there from the star of the show. So that's sweet, but. Yeah, so...
Sounds like the Capaldiest of ideas.
Again, just... This was a super Capaldi episode. The Capaldiest.
The Capaldiest of episodes.
I don't think we'll be topping it for a little while yet, but...
Well, we'll be back, I think, with two episodes that unfortunately are not Capaldiest because he has not yet appeared. We're going to take a quick break, come back with some thoughts on the 10th Doctor's adventure, Voyage of the Damned. We'll see if that is the tenidiest episode of his tenure.
Yeah, that one doesn't work as well, does it? Don't worry, the next one's going to be easier.
The smithiest episode. We'll see if those hold up. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Tonight, I'm going to have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
Welcome back. So before we jump into our Tenetiest and Smithiest episodes, I wanted to read a little post from Mr. Neil Gaiman, frequent Doctor Who contributor, Doctor Who fanboy, famous novelist, and also just wonderful human being. So this comes from his Tumblr, which is neil-gaiman.tumblr.com. A fan wrote him a question, and he sent a little response. So the fan question went... If you could hug any Doctor Who writer, which one would you hug? I think personally I would go for Robert Sherman. He looks cuddly and that beard probably feels nice rubbing on your head. Russell T. Davies also looks quite huggable, but his propensity towards suits and lack of facial hair might not make it as pleasurable as Mr. Sherman. So very funny question there from a fan. Neil Gaiman, however, chose to write back this, that's how you speak English. I would like to hug all the women who have written for Doctor Who since 2008. All of them. I would start with... What? Nobody? That can't be right. Goes off puzzled. So way to go, Mr. Gaiman, delivering some class A sass there on your Tumblr about the terrible lack of female writers on Doctor Who.
Yeah, that one was... I'm going to go out on a limb here. Don't think that's what the fan was expecting as the answer. But it's one of those that it continues to be accurate. So it continues to be appropriate to point it out at pretty much any juncture.
Yeah, and it's nice to see Neil Gaiman. It's nice to see, I guess, a guy point this kind of stuff out. I feel like that tends to fall on girls to do this. But yeah, it's always nice to see him as an advocate.
Yeah, and a Doctor Who writer who, to be honest, as far as I know, is still on extremely good terms with the current production team. Like, I don't think this is his way of burning a bridge or something.
Yeah.
Like, I think that it's just, you know, he feels secure enough in his career. And really, Neil Gaiman doesn't need Doctor Who. I think we can go on a limb and say that right
he's
now.
He's doing okay.
He's doing fine. So I think that, you know, it is one of those things where... I do think that, you know, it does carry some extra weight when, as I say, I think it's not just a dude or a famous dude, but it's someone who, as I say, is still very much in contention to write for the show again. So, I would hope that this is perhaps quietly indicative that this is something that the show is increasingly aware of. I mean, whatever you'll say about Mummy on the Orient Express, it did have it did take a sidelong glance at the fact that its scene was failing the Bechdel test.
Yeah.
So, So, you know, as I said to you in one of our G-chats, you know, they got rid of that horrible chauvinist Stephen Moffat and replaced him with avowed super feminist Stephen Moffat this season. So,
although it was a little odd to be like, wow, this scene doesn't pass the Bechdel test, and then keep going with the scene that doesn't pass the Bechdel test.
I agree, although the previous scene,
that's true,
the first half of it had. Like, it did feel a little... So it was not a complete failure on those grounds, but just the fact that they were even pointing it out at all felt like, you know, again, I think I would have had a heart attack if that happened in season 7B. Like, I was just like, no, that's not possible.
Well, if you want to hear us talk more about the Bechdel test, we actually did that in our very first episode. So if you're brave enough to get back in the archives and seek that out, you can hear us talk about it there.
When our levels are funky and the recording doesn't sound, it's just, we're recording that on the moon by comparison, but...
the moon right before it hatched into a space dragon egg.
Not the super professional outfit that we have now. Anyway, we're deep into the second half here, so we should discuss our two episodes. So do you want to kick us off maybe with a discussion of Voyage of the Damned, Caroline?
Oh, you know I do. So, of course, both episodes this week were written by men. This episode was written by showrunner Russell T. Davies. So here is my attempt to summarize Voyage of the Damned. Let's see how well I do. It's a very odd episode.
This is a challenge. So there is a degree of difficulty on this one.
It very much is. This is the 2007 Christmas special. Picks up right where season 3 left off. Moments after Martha has said goodbye to the 10th Doctor, the TARDIS crashes into the Titanic, which turns out not to be the ocean liner, but in fact a luxury space liner from the planet Stowe, run by an eccentric businessman named Max Capricorn. So these ship's passengers, mostly kind of rich elites, are traveling to observe the primitive Earth culture, aka modern day London. The first 15 minutes of this episode are like a fun Christmas romp, which suddenly turns into the most horrific disaster movie you have ever seen. The captain purposefully crashes the ship into a meteor shower and sends it hurtling towards Earth. Presumably thousands of people die. The lucky ones that survive include the Doctor and a kooky cast of characters, which in particular includes Kylie Minogue as his temporary companion, Astrid Peth, and they are essentially navigating this damaged ship a la the Poseidon Adventure. And the body count just starts racking up here. They are fighting off these robotic golden angel hosts who are trying to kill them all. And they later have to fight off the corrupt Max Capricorn, who it turns out organized this whole crash in order to bankrupt the company that voted him out. Pretty much everybody winds up dead in this episode, including Kylie Minogue, shockingly. But that's okay because the Doctor stops the Space Titanic from crashing into Buckingham Palace and killing Queen Elizabeth. Happy Christmas! How did I do?
That was extremely thorough and got everything in, other than the fact that Wilf shows up in this
and
episode.
And Wilf shows up, that's true.
Which is by far the sweetest, nicest part of the episode.
It's always nice to see Bernard Cribbs here.
Early role before he was Donna's grandfather, when he was just a guy
on the street. So Voyage of the Damned is, I think, the best thing you can say about it is that it is hard to look away from this episode. It is bizarre in a way that makes you want to keep watching because you're like, what weird thing will they add on next? It doesn't particularly feel cohesive. It doesn't really feel like the tone is consistent. It doesn't really feel like it has a clear thing it's trying to say. But in its own bizarre, weird way, it's kind of fun to watch. Do you agree or disagree?
I do kind of agree because I think that there is something majestic about an episode so committed to the lunacy of its own ambition.
Yeah.
Like, because it's not wrongheaded in the same way that the preceding Master two-parter is wrongheaded, where like it's just like, oh dear God, you know, this is, what are you even saying? Like this is, and there's nothing as sort of straight up ridiculous as the Dobby Doctor in this. Although the Doctor like letting the two hosts lift him up through the sky is to the flight deck is up there.
Yeah, that is a moment.
That's a thing. That's a thing that happens, and we all witnessed it.
I have watched it twice because I was so amused by it.
And also the Queen's cameo in this.
Yeah.
God, there's so many deeply, deeply ridiculous things in this. I mean, I remember that I think there's a quote that Stephen Moffat, who after, you know, Russell T. Davies departed, took up the Christmas writing specials, which is like, you just want to make it kind of, you know, the sort of challenge with them is you kind of want to make them as frothy and, you know, fun and sort of accessible to, you know, the family that's probably a little drunk at this mm-hmm. point. Like, that's sort of the target audience you're writing. I like that Russell T. Davies, he don't play that. He goes no. in completely, he just takes, like, he makes you think that's what he's doing. And then, as you say, like, the bodies just start piling up and the deaths are as sort of ignominious and hard-edged, like so the married couple mm-hmm. on this who are defined by their the fact that they're on the large side and sort of definitely fits into the sort of Russell T. Davies just seeming to find fat people really funny. And I think we discussed this in Partners in mm-hmm. Crime as well. They're definitely like characters you're supposed to root for and are nicely played, but at the same time, there's literally a fat joke every single time they appear on screen.
Yeah, I found them more sympathetic on this rewatch, though. I thought that
I think they're sympathetic. I don't sympathize with the way the episode handles them, if that makes sense.
Does.
Like, they feel like objects as opposed to subjects, mm-hmm. I think, is the difference.
Well, it also doesn't help that the husband, Morven Van Hoff, just like straight up falls off and dies
kind
of for
that's
no
where
reason.
I was that this long parenthetical, that was where I was getting back to. He has the worst death in Doctor Who history, because there's absolutely it is like Russell T. Davies was like, you know, staying up late the day before filming was going to start writing this thing, and knowing his writing style, that's entirely plausible, and just ran out of any way to kill off the characters. Like, oh, let's just have him fall off a ledge, that'll be fine.
And it doesn't
let's
help that everybody else, including his wife Foon, Astrid, and Banna Cephalata. Thank you. They all get these really kind of actually noble, beautiful deaths. And then Morven feels just like you said, a total afterthought of like, well, we need Foon to be sad and sacrifice herself, so let's get him out of the way really quickly, which I think you're right is a little bit weird. I really love disaster movies, so on some level, I can just appreciate this as a weird attempt to mimic this genre that I love. And on this rewatch, I was trying to kind of find some themes that relate to the rest of the season. They're there, in a way. This idea of the Doctor sort of inspiring people to be like him, and then that leads to their death, of course, will become really relevant in the season finale. Also, this is kind of where we get the start of the Doctor conceptualizing himself as almost a godlike being. A moment I picked up on was when he's trying to bring Astrid back by teleporting her kind of her atoms back, and the machine isn't quite working, and David Tennant like is smacking it, and he just yells, "I can do anything." And I think that will, of course, get a really great payoff in Waters of Mars. So I was a little bit surprised that there was some of that threaded through here. Certainly not the focus of the episode, but at least there was a little bit of something to hold on to besides just the delightful disaster movie tropes.
Yeah, and I think you could even argue that the way that Astrid interacts with the Doctor is so... It is one of the most explicitly romantic pairings mm-hmm. that the Tenth Doctor has, and it feels like it's sort of coming out of the relationship with Martha, which was so poorly defined, and that's the reason why, a big reason why it ended in the end. And then in Partners in Crime, the Tenth Doctor being very explicit with Donna that I just want to mate. Like, you could sort of feel that there's some way that this sort of slots into the Tenth Doctor's sort of growing understanding. No, I am, like, people see me as an attractive person, mm-hmm. and I need to be kind of cognizant of that I can't just sort of keep blithely walking through situations not aware of the impact that my appearance has. And admittedly, he's fairly coy about it most of the time, but it feels like that is an aspect of the story that sort of fits in here. So, you know, I don't think that Voyage of the Damned is an entirely ineffective story. I think that you're right that sort of leaving aside its weirdness, and I mean, the weirdness is like 90% of this episode. But I actually do think there are some interesting ideas here. I actually like the Doctor and Astrid's relationship. I think Kylie Minogue is you know, I don't think she's, you know, incredible here, but I think she's fine as the companion character.
100% better than she needs to be a famous pop star in a Doctor Who episode.
Yeah, and again, actually, another comparison point with Mummy on the Orient Express, Kylie Minogue, also a huge Doctor Who fan. Like, apparently, there's, like, a photo of her, like, just reading a Doctor Who tie-in novel.
Everybody. Skinner, Kylie Minogue. You can't get those Doctor Who fans away from the show.
Yeah, and, you know, she's not even British. She's Australian. So, you know, it's just everywhere in the old empire.
Yeah,
there. And the other thing I will point out, I kind of love, just because he's so unlikable, the character of Rixton Slade.
Yeah.
I think that's the most he's by far the most interesting character in the episode, because there's just nothing redeeming about him whatsoever, and I love that the script owns it, and Gray O'Brien in his performance just owns it. At no point does he try to soften the character at all, and I think you're right that, again, it feels like the follow through on that is it doesn't quite feel like it lands like any super coherent point about that beyond, well, the Doctor shouldn't choose who lives and who dies, and sometimes the wrong people live.
Mm-hmm.
But it is it's just another thing to throw into this sort of mix of, like, Voyage of the Damned is sort of – it feels like that kind of, you know, that drunk friend who sort of grabbed you by the scruff of the neck and is telling you something that doesn't really make any sense. But he is super, super committed to whatever point he thinks he's making, and you kind of have to respect it at like by minute 72 of that.
That sounds like the perfect Christmas episode then, because what else is Christmas about but drunken relatives telling you incoherent things?
This does feel like your drunk uncle just, like, airing his political views over turkey. Like I think, you know, that kind of is Voyage of the Damned.
Go ahead.
No, the other thing we should just mention, because I think you want to move on to dinosaurs in a second, but the other thing we should mention is Russell T. Davies. I believe his biggest crush is Russell Tovey, who is on board here as midshipman Alonzo Frame. I think that's the other sort of big side character of the episode, and the one who returns in End of Time Part 2, because they needed to represent this episode somehow in End of Time Part 2.
I'm a big Russell Tovey fan as well. He's another one of those guys that was in the original History Boys. Also plays a really good character on the HBO show Looking. Also has a really great Instagram account, takes lots of pictures of his bulldog, and uses lots of hashtags in a way that I find delightfully desperate for an actor that I would consider fairly well known to be using that many, like, hashtag Frenchie Bulldog.
Just trying to build up a brand when it's like, no, you kind of already have a brand.
You're doing okay.
You don't need to do this. Another kind of character who sort of fits in a sort of semi quasi companion of the week kind of role, and I think does a very nice job, considering most of the episode he has to spend nursing a wound by himself in the deck. So it's an episode that definitely benefits from a good cast.
Mm-hmm. And I actually think that even though he and David Tennant are not often actually on screen together, they work very well as a pairing, even when they're just speaking over the like intercom system. And then especially that scene where they're both in the room at the end and they're kind of just sitting on the floor there. They do really nice work together, surprisingly so, I think. So overall, I think this is actually a fairly good David Tennant episode. This is one where his kind of commitment to the character makes almost everything work, I would say, except for the angel rising into the sky Jesus moment, which I am not sure anyone could make work, really.
Yeah, I mean, if this episode weren't so conceptually flawed, like, I think it does work in large measure, because I think the cast in general is strong. I didn't even mention Jeffrey Palmer, who's a longtime Who veteran who's on board as the captain, mm-hmm. and brings a ton of pathos to a really tiny role. And also Clive Swift, who is also in Classic Who as Mr. Copper, who I think also helps anchor the emotional beats that they're going for at the end of the episode, which feel wholly unearned because of the carnage you've just watched, where they're trying to go for this very sentimental kind of ending. But I think you're right. This actually could be one of the most Tennant-y episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tennant-iest.
The Tennant-y, it's a hard word to get out.
It really is.
Possibly because it is not a word. But this is one where you could not rewrite this for any of the other Doctors.
Yeah.
It would not work at all. You need the dashing, swashbuckling, take charge kind of Doctor. And I think that may be an indication of sometimes there are just stories that aren't good at all, and even though they fit the persona, just should not be told anyway, but it definitely feels like one where this incarnation is the only one where it would work in the slightest.
We should also give a shout out to Jimmy V as Banna Cafalata. I don't know why that's so hard for me to say. Who is another guy that's on Who a lot, which I just learned in the bonus for the character, the bonus content for the caretaker. I believe he's inside the what's that robot thing called?
The Scovox Blitzer, I believe.
So Jimmy V only plays bizarrely named creatures on Doctor Who.
Yeah, he's the Mox of Balhoon way back in End of the World. He's the Grask and the Grosk. He's both of them. He's any alien that is sort of below 5 feet. Mm-hmm. That's Jimmy V. Any alien that is larger than that, I believe, is Paul Casey, who's the host in this. I think that's correct. Yeah.
But I thought he brought Banna Cafalata.
You got it. Just keep going.
I think he brought a lot of respect and dignity to a character that could have otherwise been more of a punchline.
Yeah, and I think that I feel much the same way as I do with Foon and Morven Van Hoff, that I have no criticism of Debbie Chazen and Clive Rowe as the actors who play it. I think that they do a really nice work with the material they're given, and there's sort of that feint towards respecting them in the scripts, but at the same time, I think Banna Cafalata is still, he is kind of a gimmick character or a punchline of a character. Like, there's a lot of things like, oh, he refers to himself in the third person, and he's a cyborg, which comes out of nowhere.
No, I love that part. That might be my favorite part of the episode.
Where he and Astrid are sort of discussing it, or where he uses his cyborg power to kill the host.
Both. I really like when he uses his cyborg power. I think it's a nice, I mean, it's really goofy. It's an example of like world building that doesn't quite work, but it's also kind of interesting. We've got this parallel to, you know, some sort of social thing that you need to hide of yourself that's becoming more and more acceptable.
Well, I think it's a couple things that I have the issue with there. I think it's one of those things where, well, first of all, he's the only non-human non-humanoid character, and now also he's a cyborg. Yeah. And it's like, this is feeling, wait, so what? Like, it feels a little muddled that they're doing it for the one character who doesn't look like everyone else to begin with. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think, like, the whole cyborg thing, like, this idea that Stowe has this weird prejudice against cyborgs, it kind of works when Clive Swift briefly mentions or Clive Swift's character, Mr. Copper, mentions the cyborg caravans, and suggesting they're kind of like the Roma of Stowe, which is, that's actually a really fascinating idea, but doesn't work when you're like, oh, wait, the whole thing is just to, like, justify the fact that Max Capricorn is a head, can't run a business, and it just feels like very, I don't want to say lazy plotting, but I think that's what it is. So it's, you got to respect this episode's lunatic ambition, but I think we're in agreement. Doesn't really pull it off to a great extent.
Well, maybe let's talk about an episode that has similar ambition, and I think we both agree pulls it off a little bit better. So you want to give us a quick summary of Dinosaurs on a Spaceship?
Yeah, Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. This is the one where the Doctor has a million companions. He's got a gang now. This is 11th Doctor, Series 7, Amy and Rory, but it's also Queen Nefertiti of Egypt, and also John Riddell, Big Game Hunter, played by Rupert Graves of Sherlock. So Moffat bring out, I think, the highest profile Sherlock person to appear on Doctor
Who.
Yeah,
I always forget he's on that, because he's just a big actor in general.
Yeah, he does a lot of good stuff. I really like him as just a presence. So they're all brought together to investigate this strange, gigantic spaceship. Like a spaceship, I believe, the size of Canada, which is just, that's insane how big that is. Which is on a collision course with Earth in the, I think it's the 24th century. Mm-hmm. And the Indian Space Agency, kind of cool to suggest that the India is basically running the world at that point, is going to have to shoot the thing down if the Doctor can't figure out what's going on. So he enlists his gang, which inadvertently includes Brian Williams, Rory's dad, who is awesome, and is played by, just to keep this confusing as possible, Mark Williams plays Brian Williams. We had the same confusion when we were discussing Power of Three, and is called, of course, also Arthur Weasley in the Harry Potter movies. There's actually quite a few Harry Potter alums here, because the guy behind it all is David Bradley, who is Filch in the Harry Potter movies and is also whoever that really awful dude on Game of Thrones is. Walder Frey. That's it.
He was also on Grace Point. No, Broadchurch with David Tennant.
Broadchurch. Yes, where he is not playing the most horrific person in the world. But here he is. Oh, dear goodness, he is. He's this sort of seedy, traitor, murderous, just completely unscrupulous character who basically, it turns out, I haven't even mentioned the dinosaurs yet.
It's okay. They're implied in the title.
They're implied by the title. There are dinosaurs on this ship because it's a Silurian arc. The Silurians put a bunch of dinosaurs on this spaceship, went into deep space because the moon was coming and they were afraid what the impact was going to do to them.
The moon, which of course is an egg.
It's not a completely perfect fit, I suppose. Basically, the Doctor and his coterie of companions must both sort of navigate this dinosaur-filled spaceship and figure out what to do with Solomon, who's David Bradley's character, who, again, is pretty much evil incarnate as Doctor Who villains go. Like, it's really hard to come up with a character who's less redeemable than Solomon is here, which indeed leads into kind of the weirdest part of the episode, like the weirdest hard left turn this episode takes, because it's generally a romp, and one of the most fun Doctor Who episodes you could ever watch. Like, David Mitchell and Robert Webb are on hand to voice a pair of crotchety robots, which is just a complete joke from start to finish. Very slapsticky kind of humor there. But then the Doctor basically arranges Solomon's death, and arranges is a little euphemistic. Like, if you want to argue that the Doctor straight up kills Solomon at the end of this episode, I think it's about as justifiable here as it is in any other instance you could care to name, which is, I think, the sort of weird thing that doesn't quite seem to fit with the tone the rest of the episode is going for, and I'm sure we'll have some more discussion of that. But that in a nutshell, a very large, expansive, non-linear nutshell, is what Dinosaurs on a Spaceship is all about.
And what
congrats. I think you did the better synopsis this week.
Well, I was going to say, what is Doctor Who but a large, non-linear nutshell?
Yeah, you can have that one for free, Stephen Moffat.
Dinosaurs on a Spaceship is a really fun episode. Your summary kind of made it sound crazy, and it is crazy, but it pulls off this craziness remarkably well. I would say it kind of really balances this kooky cast of characters by smartly dividing them so that Amy is with Nefertiti and the big game hunter whose name I have already forgotten.
John Riddell.
Thank you. Of course, history has also forgotten it, so I guess that is to be expected. Meanwhile, the Doctor is of course with Rory and Brian, and I think that's a smart way to kind of handle the character work here. We get fun interactions between those trio. Between that trio in a way I'm not sure we really could if they were all in one group together. So I think that was a really smart way to handle these various characters and really to show that Amy is very much coming into her own here as a companion. You know, she's almost functioning as a second Doctor, and Nefertiti and Riddell are kind of looking to her as if she is the Doctor figure in this case.
Yeah, I think Amy actually refers to them as her companions at one point.
She says, I won't have my companions flirting.
Exactly. Absolutely accurate. And I think you're right. It's a very disciplined episode in terms of just the structure of it. Chris Chibnall wrote this, and of course he went on to write Broadchurch. Mm-hmm. So there's some, you know, I don't know whether this, I'm sure he was aware of David Bradley before this, but it's nice that one of the Broadchurch alums is retroactively involved in this episode. But yeah, you're right that I think that it's very clever in splitting them up almost immediately and definitely zeroing in on what are the most fun trios here, because it lets everyone get multiple moments in the spotlight in a way. I think you're right. If they were trying to juggle six characters hanging out at the same time, it would never work.
And we often say that the Moffat era is much funnier than the Russell T. Davies era, and I think that we get a really clear example of that here. You know, compared to Voyage of the Damned, which has many attempts at humor, I think Dinosaurs on a Spaceship is much more successful when it comes to the humor. Brian and Rory's relationship is fantastic, really funny, also kind of really moving in the end. But I really think that Karen Gillan and Amy kind of steal the show here in terms of the, like, underplayed one-liners. She gets a lot of really good ones when she tells Nefertiti that she is in fact a queen when she accidentally says that she's Rory's queen. And then she gets some good little barbs in it, Riddell. And I think my favorite part is when he says that it's a two-man job and she says, I'm worth two men you could come to if you want to. One of my all-time favorite Amy Pond moments.
And also when he asks, you know what I need? And she says, what, a lesson in gender politics?
Yeah.
I do like that John Riddell is unquestionably the biggest butt of jokes in this episode, and especially when he says when Amy calls him a walking innuendo, like mm-hmm. it feels like they kind of took because I know I mean that's that. Recalls how Mickey described Captain Jack way back in Boomtown, and I don't think they're intentionally doing that, but it definitely feels like they're taking that archetype and just saying, okay, this time we're not even going to try to make it charming. We're just going to admit these characters are kind of unbearable. These sort of Flashman kind of archetypes, it is again, I think credit to Rupert Graves for like finding a way to make the character likable, but still a complete chauvinist pig. Like, it's a fun line that they kind of walk in that it doesn't feel like a complete caricature, which is nifty.
I also think the dinosaurs look really good, really surprisingly good for a TV show. You know, they're not quite Jurassic Park level, but it is not something where the CGI is too distracting or anything. And I like that the episode kind of goes half Jurassic Park, half Flintstones. Like, the dinosaurs are either, like, serious, dangerous raptors or, like, a triceratops that likes to play fetch. I just like that choice very much fits the tone of this episode, I think.
I think you make an interesting point about the budget, too, because, I mean, 7A, this is, of course, the super short season of Doctor Who, the one where there's only five mm-hmm. episodes, because I do not count Doctor the Widow and the Wardrobe as part of 7A. I just forget that it exists. And I think that, again, I forget the exact reasons. I mean, I think it was just that the BBC didn't have enough money to give to more than a handful of episodes. But you can tell this is the mini season where they said, oh, everything's going to be like a mini movie. And Dinosaurs definitely lives up to that billing. All of the 7A episodes look amazing. And this one, I think you're right. Like, I doubt they could pull off Dinosaurs on this sort of scale in any other sort of time in the show's history. Because I do think the fact that they just only had to, you know, pay for five episodes means that they could stretch the budget much more so than they could in others. And it is very impressive how good the dinosaurs look. They're not always 100% convincing, but they're dinosaurs, for goodness sake, as you say, on a BBC budget. Like, if you're going to grade on any kind of curve, it's sensational what they pull off here.
And I think they're much better used here than that T-Rex in Deep Breath, which always felt like a slightly an odd choice. But I think actually the dinosaurs are appropriately kind of magical here, both for the characters and for us as an audience.
Yeah, aside, I have to say that the deeper I get into season 8, the Deep Breath just feels a million years ago.
It does.
Because it is, like, I think it's the one clunker of the season. I know you're not crazy about Mummy, but it's, like, the one episode that just really feels, it just feels like such a, like, well, it feels very much of, like, an 11th Doctor era episode, mm-hmm. and then everything after that feels much more coherent and unified in its identity. And so it is, just that's my quick thought on Deep Breath, but I think you're right that here there's much better use of dinosaurs. It really lives up to that idea that there are dinosaurs and they're on a spaceship.
I think we previously sung Brian's praises when we talked about the Power of Three, but yeah, I was going to say you really can't do it enough. He's just such a well-realized character. He's such a recognizable dad. You just get the sense when it kind of, we get that scene where he's, you know, middle of fixing a light bulb with Amy and Rory. And you just know that he came over, you know, for like tea or something. And was like, oh, this light bulb's broken. And Rory's like, okay, don't worry about it, Dad. Like, we'll fix it later. And he's like, nope, we're going to do it now. Like, this is the job. You have to fix these things immediately. Like, you have such a good sense of this character existing beyond, you know, the edges of this story, which to me is always the mark of a well-written character. The fact that he carries that trowel around. He just has a very particular worldview, and it is delightful to watch.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he basically, his day was walking around Ledworth, going over to Amy and Rory's house. If he saw some gardening that needed doing, he's got a trowel, and it could be in their house. It could be on a street. Doesn't matter. It's just wherever he sees a need for it, the trowel will be out, and he's got his two golf balls because he's going to go over to the golf club later. Of course he's going to. Like, that's his day.
Yeah.
That's what Brian Williams does. Because Brian Williams doesn't need anything more. But then the idea that by the end of the episode he totally does is so sweet.
Yeah, it really is. And the other moment that always gets me is when Rory reveals that he carries around not a trowel in his pocket, but a first aid kit. It's just such a lovely way of, like, you see that these two men are from the same family. You see the influence of Brian in Rory, but you see how it's kind of taken a different path. And it's very sweet when Rory's like, oh, you get to see me use my nursing skills here. And a nice little foreshadowing, I guess, to the fact that their relationship is kind of what saves the day, because they're their genetic connection is what allows them to steer the Silurian spaceship away from danger. And I also like Brian kind of not quite understanding what is required of him, but very eagerly volunteering if he and Rory can in any way help to kind of help the Doctor by piloting the ship.
Yeah, it takes a real talent, I think, to write characters who are limited, he's not a limited character by the end of the episode, but to write limited characters in a way that doesn't feel like they're dumb. And I think a couple things, like, I love the fact that, again, like, he has a world, like, I love that he just disparagingly refers to the Doctor as Arthur C. Clarke. Like, it just implies this whole, like, yeah, no, he's read books.
Yeah.
Like, he's aware of science fiction. Like, it's just, there are these little details that take a character who could be flat but brilliantly played, because as soon as you cast Mark Williams, the character, you've done like 80% of the job is done for you when Mark Williams agrees to play a character like this. But the fact that he just pops off the page so much that a lesser actor still could have done great work as him, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It's very, very well written. Probably better written than Nefertiti or Riddell, who are kind of funny archetypes, but I don't think in the way that Brian feels like he exists off the page, I'm not sure that they do as well. They're still really fun characters to have here, but I think Brian definitely takes the cake when it comes to guest stars.
I think you can definitely say, like, the joke trio is Amy, Nefertiti, and Riddell, and the character trio is the Doctor, Rory, and Brian. And I think that they definitely fulfill very different functions in the story. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that with those other characters, it's much more, okay, we've got Rupert Graves, and Rupert Graves is going to bring a specific thing to the part, and, you know, that he'll pull the character together, and we can kind of focus on the one-liners and letting him play off of the other two characters. And I think it's similar with Nefertiti, that Rhianne Steele, I hope I'm pronouncing her first name correctly, is very much in that same sort of thing. I think she's very good, and it's a part that is, it's a functionally written character. It's not a character that's written to really have a rich inner existence otherwise. But she does feel like a queen, and I guess that's what you kind of need her to do.
And I guess it's worth spending a little time talking about the rather controversial ending of this episode, in which I would call it that the Doctor pulls a Batman, where he doesn't exactly kill him, but he allows him to die, and somehow that kind of allows him to keep his moral high ground. I think you're right that it's very shocking that this is how the episode ends. I can't recall any other time in which the Doctor let someone die in a case that didn't involve self-defense. Like, I know the 10th Doctor kind of does something similar at the end of the Christmas Invasion when he says no second chances. But in that case, you could argue that it was self-defense, that he literally, you know, was about to be killed, and so he had to kill the other guy. Whereas here, the Doctor had every chance to take Solomon and put him in jail or something, and he just chooses not to do that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a very interesting decision, and I'm going to loop back to something I was saying earlier, where I think one of the great benefits of the shorter season was you could put more money in and you could make them feel like movies and dinosaurs. It looks great, and I think, you know, like 95% of it is really successful because they've got a lot of money clearly to spend on and know exactly how to use the money that they have. I think that the downside, when you've got a 5-episode season, you can't do any serialized character work. And this feels like the start. This feels like they're setting up something, and there's no time to pay it off whatsoever. None of the subsequent episodes pay off the Doctor's decision here in any way, shape, or form. Whereas if this were episode 2 of a 12 or 13 episode season, you could say, okay, there's going to be a reckoning at some point. You're going to deal with this in some way. And we're seeing that in series 8, which has had a ton of sort of inter-episode carryover and developing the ideas of who the Doctor is and what his relationship with Clara is over the season. Again, here, it's a dead end, and it's a really funky dead end to have.
And in fact, it almost feels ignored, like purposely ignored in a town called Mercy, which is the next episode, where it feels like the Doctor is saying, I never get to, you know, I never get to be vengeful. I never get to, like, let the bad guy die at the end. And that's kind of his central moral dilemma in a town called Mercy. And yet, in the episode previous, that's exactly what he did. He just let the bad guy die, and it was all fine. Like, it seems like they're really odd, the lack of at least character serialization there. Because I think you're right, this feels like a huge shift, a huge decision for the Doctor. And it's interesting to watch, and I think you're right, if it had been dealt with, it could have been a really cool element of Eleven's character. But unfortunately, it just feels like a weird standalone moment here.
Yeah, because I think you're right. I mean, you remind me of A Town Called Mercy. He says, today I honor the victims first.
Yeah.
That's absolutely what he's doing here because, I mean, he asks, did the Silurians beg for their lives?
Which is a great line and
it's
really
a great
well delivered.
Line. I think this is I think actually 7A is very good to the 11th mm-hmm. Doctor because the 11th Doctor is generally when Amy and Rory are there, the 11th Doctor generally works, and it's 7B where they run into a lot of troubles keeping the character coherent. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of the really latter-day great 11th Doctor episodes. I think Matt Smith is really on point here, and I think it's a lovely mix of the sort of comedy and some very goofy, whimsical stuff, but also some really hard-edged drama, and I think you're right. Like, I love that line, and I think that he really does it very well. But yeah, you're right. Town Called Mercy, like, if at any point they'd said, wasn't that exactly what you did with Solomon? And again, I mean, it feels justified in the sense that, again, like, the script and David Bradley's performance make Solomon the single most detestable character we've met across 8 years. Like, there's nothing good about him whatsoever. But it's still that shouldn't really matter if the Doctor's this good man that he believes himself in this incarnation to be. So it's a very weird pivot to not then follow up on in any way.
It is. And I almost feel like the way I feel in Asylum of the Daleks, where I really like the Amy Rory fight as a scene, like as written and as acted. It just doesn't make sense to me in the larger context of the series. And I feel similarly here. Like, I really like this pivot. I really like this moment as written and acted, but again, it just feels so separate from everything else. So I'm kind of two minds about it, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right that 7A, it just has a lot of that sort of stuff, and it's like Power of Three is it's a fantastic episode in terms of like wrapping up the Dr. Amy Rory relationship mm-hmm. and sort of looking at its strengths and its weaknesses and contrasting doctor life and real life, and it ends on a very nice note. And then it just feels like it doesn't lead into Angels Take Manhattan at all.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like that's going in completely the opposite direction. And so it's one of those things where if you look at – and also Town Called Mercy. We really like Town Called mm-hmm. Mercy as well. I really like individually all five episodes of this season, and I think that each of them as a standalone works really well. But I think that what probably – undercut 7A is that there's not quite enough discipline in saying, okay, if we're going to do standalone, we need to do standalone. We can't then do these serialized moments because we have to be realistic about the fact that we're not going to be able to follow up on them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I agree. 7A, I think the standalones are really strong and that there's just something missing. And it is really nice to see, you know, we've been praising season 8 for doing something different, and I feel like they really are paying much more attention to the serialization character-wise there, and I do appreciate that. I guess final thoughts here. I don't think the robots, the Mitchell and Webb robots, work for me. They're a hair too silly, and I think without them, the episode would maybe be a little bit stronger.
I'll say, Mitchell and Webb are my favorite comedy duo working.
There you go.
So I like him all right. I mean, it's one of those things where I don't think if it were any other comedians, it would work for me. It's only because I kind of know that this is such a silly over. Like, if I thought that for a second, this is just what Mitchell and Webb do, like this is their comedy, mm-hmm. then I think it would feel really embarrassing. Here, the fact that it's sort of arch because you've gotten two of the more highbrow, mm-hmm. comedic actors to come and do the silliest, dumbest robots imaginable in the silliest, sort of goofiest voices that they could be asked to do. It feels very Python-esque is what it feels like. I don't know whether it works in any kind of structural way. I think it's probably just my enduring goodwill for Mitchell and Webb. And I think that there are – you know what? I'm not even sure it goes to Python level. It's like a kind of like Muppet humor even. Like it's that kind of thing. And it doesn't really feel of a kind with any of the other humor they're doing here, because if we're sort of doing the sort of cataloging of the humor here, there's that, which is super broad, and then there's the sort of 11th Doctor humor, which is the sort of just completely like just saying the most ridiculous things and then believing them with absolute conviction, which is sort of that archetypal 11th Doctor joke. And then it's the sort of Amy Riddell Nefertiti, like one-liner snarky sitcom kind of thing. And I think Any two of those could probably work together, but I think you're right that all three of them together is just too weird a stew to make work.
I also cannot believe that Doctor Who did a joke about balls, in this case golf balls, but I'm always like scandalized when I hear that.
I just love Rory's reaction to it.
Yeah, it's great.
He is so mortified because I think he... And it's one of those things where he either honestly thinks his dad was talking about, like, his balls, which is mortifying, or he knows exactly what his dad is actually talking about. And either way, it is the most embarrassing thing imaginable for Rory. And I think we mentioned this in – I suspect I mentioned this in the Power of Three, but I do think a lot of credit goes to Arthur Darvill as well for just making that relationship just so completely believable. Like, you never for a second doubt that Rory is Brian's son. And despite the fact that they're very different because, again, I mean – Brian Williams is just the most dad person imaginable. And then Rory and particularly Arthur Darvill is just like this super hipster dude. And it's one of those things where it's not that they're like super similar in appearance, but they're super similar, as you say, in like kind of worldview. Mm-hmm. And it's very nice how well that works. I think the episode would otherwise just feel so completely ungrounded without that, just to give that little hint of sort of real life to it.
And one other moment I just remembered as we're wrapping up is the Rory Dr. Kiss. And much like Barb, I have to admit to being a little bit hypocritical because I know previously we've kind of been harsh on the show for having these non-consensual kisses where the 11th Doctor just like kisses some woman. I think notably in the Crimson Horror, he does this to Jenny. Much more elaborate. He kind of like pulls her, dips her down and like really lays one on her. That really bothers me for whatever reason. And again, this might be like kind of sexist, but this kiss between Rory and the Doctor is just delightful to me. And I was trying to justify it as like, maybe we know these characters together more. We know the kiss is less aggressive. I don't really think there's a way to justify it. I think it just feels less threatening because it's another man. And because of that, I just find it really funny and really delightful. And I think Matt Smith might've just done it without telling Arthur Darvill, which makes it even more delightful.
I think it is. I think it's a combination of all those things. I mean, I do think that if, you know, the Doctor had been traveling in the TARDIS with Jenny for like almost two full seasons at that point, maybe it'd feel a little different. But I think you're probably right. It is the fact that the primary thing is Rory's a man and Jenny's a woman, and that there's a whole bunch of like social expectations that are kind of coded into it. And it just, as you say, it just does not feel as threatening because, you know, Rory is just, he is a dude. And I think also I think part of it is the reaction and how they sell it, because again, it's like this response of like a slap, which just feels like something out of like a 60s, like Carry On kind of movie. And it's just in Crimson Horror. And it just feels like, oh, we're playing it as, you know, and it, you know, whatever that is. Whereas like Rory whatever that voice was, but that was the right voice. I just don't know quite where it came from. Whereas Rory is like, he just like wants to get the taste out of his mouth. It's just sort of like, wait, what just happened? It feels more real.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels a little more modern, less jokey sense. I don't know. It's one of those things. It's hard to pin down. And you're probably right that it's one of those things that, you know, it probably reveals some inequality somewhere that needs to be dealt with. But at the same time, it's a funny thing in the moment. And I think it's less troublesome to have, you know, an issue with the kiss with Jenny and then not have exactly the same issue with the Rory kiss. I think that that's okay in the end.
Well, three very odd episodes this week. I think Dinosaurs on a Spaceship might be my favorite of Voyage the Damned Mummy and the Orient Express. And Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, that I think is the one that works the best for me. But I think it's time to set up our debate for next week. Does that sound good to you?
It does indeed.
All right. So next week is a Dr. Light episode in which the focus is going to be much more on Clara kind of stepping into the Doctor's shoes, taking on his role. So we wanted to look at two episodes in which the Doctor is somehow kept from the action and the companion has to step up her game. So we're going to look at the second season episode, Fear Her, and which features Rose. And then the third season episode, 42, which features Martha kind of trying to take some stabs at independence maybe in that episode. So hopefully those will hold up with next week's episode, Flatline. And as always, you can reach out to us at Debating DW on Twitter. We are Debating Doctor Who @gmail.com. Send us an email if you want to win the Danielle fan email of the week. You can also find us at debatingdoctorwho.tumblr.com. And until next week, bye.
See ya.
Don't stop. Like a tiger defying the laws of gravity. I'm a racing car buzzing.